Welcome to the Baseball Podcast. It is November 20th, and if you follow Major League Baseball, you know this isn't just the hot stove heating up.
Oh, no. This is the pressure cooker.
It's the pressure cooker moment of the offseason calendar. Exactly. All these deadlines are driving the action. They're forcing front offices to make commitments that are going to shape their rosters and their payrolls for the next few years.
That's the critical distinction right there. We are, you know, we're past the purely speculative rumor mill phase.
Right.
We're into the part where financial and contractual realities, they bite. We just saw it with the qualifying offer deadline. 4 surprising acceptances, and that immediately tightens up budgets across the league.
And we've got the non-tender deadline looming just days away. That's another one that forces these really tough strategic financial decisions.
Yeah, on players they might otherwise want to keep. It's that volatility, you know, that's making the trade market move at, breakneck speed right now.
It really is. We have a massive amount of material to sift through today. We're going to start with the flurry of moves from Atlanta and Houston. Then there's that true blockbuster trade between the Orioles and Angels that we have to break down.
Oh, the risk versus control on that one is fascinating.
It is.
Man.
And of course, the big names, Cody Bellinger, Pete Alonso, and the starting pitcher everyone wants, Carrick Skubal.
So our mission today is to really give you the context and I think the financial clarity behind these transactions.
Yeah.
Like, why is Baltimore willing to trade away 4 years of control for 1 year of a slugger? How does shedding, you know, $7 million in salaries suddenly become the most important move for a team chasing a $300 million free agent?
Right.
We're going to unpack those strategic decisions and hopefully provide the insight you need to understand what truly matters most in the league right now.
Let's jump right in with the team that always seems to operate ahead of the curve, the Atlanta Braves. Their GM, Alex Anthopoulos, has this history of trying to secure known commodities early,
right? Yeah.
To kind of insulate his team from the chaos.
Yeah, he hates getting caught in the peak free agency market. He wants his guys locked in.
Mm-hmm.
And he executed that philosophy immediately by locking down his elite closer, Raisel Iglesias.
This was a huge piece of business for them, and it tells you a lot about where the market is for those high leverage bullpen arms.
It's a fantastic signal.
Yeah.
Iglesias re-signed with the Braves on a 1 year, $16 million deal. And that AAV, the annual average value, that is definitely at the top end of what people projected.
But it's a reflection of the demand.
Oh, the intense demand.
And when we talk about demand, we're talking about serious, heavy-hitting contenders who are all in on him.
Right. He reportedly turned down offers at that exact same $16 million figure from both the Dodgers and the Blue Jays.
And the Mets and Orioles were in there, too. Heavily. So when you see 3 or 4 serious contenders all willing to pay that premium for just a single year of relief work, it tells you everything about how front offices value late game security.
Especially heading into the final year of this current CBA cycle.
It also tells you about the confidence the Braves have in him, even though 2025 is a bit of an uneven season for him.
Well, the final stat line was good, a 3.21 ERA, 29 saves, but that doesn't really tell the whole story, does it?
Not at all. He started a little slow, but then he just found his groove. Over his final 45 outings of the season, his ERA plummeted to an incredible 1.25.
Wow.
That dominance, especially late in the season when the games really mattered, that's what secured this massive contract. It was an essential move for Atlanta, especially since their bullpen already has some question marks.
Like Joe Jimenez recovering from shoulder surgery.
Exactly. You need that anchor at the back end.
So securing the closer was the anchor move, but then right after, Atlanta made a slightly more subtle strategic trade. They swapped utility infielders with the Houston Astros.
Mauricio Dubon for Nick Allen.
And this trade, it really shines a light on what contenders prioritize versus what, you know, financially constrained teams need to do.
Precisely. For Atlanta, this acquisition is all about defensive versatility and having a reliable offensive floor off your bench.
Dubon is a former Gold Glove winner. He swings right-handed. He can play second, third, short.
And even give you emergency coverage in center field. I mean, that level of flexibility is pure gold for a deep roster.
And the offensive component is key here. Dubon's bat did decline a little bit in 2025.
Yeah, he hit .241. Not great.
But his floor is still higher than what the Braves typically get from their deep reserves.
Absolutely. Think about the scenarios he covers. He can spell Ozzie Albies or Austin Riley to keep them fresh. And maybe most strategically, if the Braves are unable to land their top target at shortstop, let's say Ha-Seong Kim signs somewhere else.
Dudon gives them a capable, proven option at the position.
It mitigates the panic. He's the insurance policy that allows Anthopoulos to operate with patience in the rest of the market.
Okay, now let's flip it. Let's look at the Houston side, because this is where the financial motivation just becomes so explicit.
This is a textbook salary dump. It's designed to free up margin money for a much, much bigger fish down the line.
So Dubon was projected to earn, what, $6 or $7 million in arbitration?
Somewhere in that range, yeah. So by trading him, Houston immediately shaves that projected salary right off their ledger.
And what they get back is Nick Allen, who is, to be fair, an elite defender.
Oh, he's incredible with the glove. Few fielders in baseball are better than him at shortstop.
But the offense is, to put it kindly, abysmal.
Brutal, actually. Allen was easily the worst qualified hitter in baseball last year.
Among players with 400 or more plate appearances in 2025, right?
That's right. He hit .211 with zero home runs. Zero. In 416 plate appearances, you just cannot survive offensively with that in an everyday role.
So Houston saves $6 to $7 million. They get a cost-controlled, defensively pristine, but cheaper utility guy.
The trade isn't about improving the roster today. It's about creating financial space for the expensive, necessary improvements they have to make this offseason.
Which primarily means their pursuit of P. Alonso, which we'll get to later.
Exactly. So shedding $7 million might sound small in the grand scheme of a, you know, $200 million payroll.
But when you're trying to land a guy who's going to demand $30 million a year.
Every margin counts.
Yeah.
It's all about staying under those crucial luxury tax thresholds. It's the difference between being able to offer Alonso $32 million AAV or only $25 million AAV. Every single dollar of flexibility gained from a move like this, it can be immediately converted into higher offers for their top targets.
Speaking of calculated risks, Atlanta also had the Davis-Daniel experiment. This one really demonstrates the razor-thin margin between finding cheap, reliable depth and, well, acquiring a player who just collapses under pressure.
Daniel was an offseason pickup from the Angels for a younger prospect, Mitch Ferris. And the rationale was sound. In 2024 with the Angels, Daniel had a solid 4.16 FIP fielding independent pitching.
So his defense wasn't carrying him.
Not at all. And crucially, he had fantastic control. His walk rate was below 5%. That profile just screams solid, cheap, fifth starter, or long reliever depth.
But when he put on the Braves uniform in 2025, the wheels just fell off.
Completely. He only made 3 big league appearances and the control just vanished. His walk rate spiked to over 15%. His velocity dipped.
It was just as bad in AAA.
It was amplified in AAA. His ERA, FIP, XFIP, they were all above 5.000 across 100 innings. The Braves just couldn't tolerate that kind of drop off.
So the end result was him being outrighted and electing free agency. The Braves basically gave up a prospect for a 3-month rental that never panned out.
It's a harsh lesson, but a necessary one. Acquiring reliable depth is incredibly difficult. Front offices are constantly looking for those diamonds in the rough, but often players like Daniel who have one great trait, they just lose it.
Which really underscores the Orioles' decision, which we're moving to next, to trade a high-value prospect for a known quantity. It's such a high-stakes, aggressive move. So if the Braves' moves were all about calculated security, the trade between the Baltimore Orioles and the Los Angeles Angels, this was desperation meeting ambition.
Absolutely. The Orioles traded former first-round pitching prospect Grayson Rodriguez for 1 year of slugger Taylor Ward.
And this immediately shows you two organizations moving in totally different, almost contradictory directions.
This is a true blockbuster based on differing timelines. For Baltimore, a team that's been building up this young core, this just screams maximum urgency. They are trading 4 years of cost-controlled, high-upside pitching.
Rodriguez is controlled until 2029.
Right. For a single year of Taylor Ward, who's going to cost him probably $14 million in arbitration.
That is an aggressive win-now calculation. You give up 4 years of control for 1 year of a bat, and Ward is the thump they need. But they have young outfielders like Colton Cowser and Heston Kjerstad already in the wings.
Well, the Orioles' internal clock is ringing loudly. Their window of contention is wide open now, and they need proven offensive production. Ward brings a high offensive floor and immediate production that maybe they don't trust from Cowser or Kjerstad yet in October.
He's also very versatile.
Extremely. He can play both corner outfield spots, handle DH duties. It gives them flexibility. This move says, we have pitching depth in the minors, and we need to maximize our World Series chances while Adley Rutschman and Gunnar Henderson are still on their rookie contracts.
Okay, on the flip side, the Angels took on significant risk but for potentially massive reward.
A huge reward.
Yeah.
They acquired a high upside pitcher who has a major health history. I mean, Rodriguez is a former top prospect with a 100-mile-per-hour fastball and a wicked slider.
But, and this is a big but, he missed the entire 2025 season after getting hurt in 2024 and then having surgery to remove bone spurs.
And their GM, Perry Minasian, he acknowledges this health gamble. But the appeal of getting 4 years of potential ace-level pitching control was just too enticing to resist. The Angels need an identity, and high-upside pitching is a great place to start.
So it's basically a bet that the surgery resolved the underlying issue, right?
That's the hope. Rodriguez himself has been very optimistic. He said the bone spurs were the root cause of the issues that led to his lat injuries, and with them removed, he's targeting a full recovery. He expects to be ready for spring training.
And if he returns to form.
The Angels win this trade, overwhelmingly. If he suffers another setback, the Orioles look brilliant for trading him at his peak prospect value.
This trade also has immediate roster fallout for the Angels, just, you know, independent of Rodriguez's health. Ward was their everyday left fielder.
And a crucial run producer. That $14 million salary is now off the books, which Minasian has said publicly allows them to pursue free agents more aggressively.
That financial flexibility is critical because they have enormous holes to fill. They desperately need another starting pitcher to anchor that rotation.
A rotation that, outside of a few young arms, is looking pretty thin.
And the offense. They lose Ward's bat. They need a starting outfielder, probably a center fielder, since Joe Adell has settled into right.
Exactly. With Mike Trout and Jorge Soler more suited for DH or limited outfield duties, the Angels need an injection of defense and consistent offense. They freed up the money to spend, but now they have to spend it wisely to fill these major gaps.
And the Angels, much like the Houston Astros, are in that difficult spot where they're trying to spend their way out of the decline.
Yeah, the Astros missed the playoffs in 2025, which officially ended that remarkable 8-year run.
It felt inevitable, maybe, but it's still jarring to see. Finishing 87-75, the steady decline in wins from 100 to 90, 88, and now 87, it just shows that slow erosion of their core.
And losing Alex Bregman and Kyle Tucker last offseason was massive. Now all-star Framber Valdez hits free agency. The cracks are definitely showing.
Their needs are incredibly specific. Health is a crisis. Yordan Alvarez only played 48 games. Josh Hader was hurt late. Ronald Blanco was out until late 2026.
The pitching staff looks very unstable outside of Hunter Brown, who, you know, he really showed some growth last year.
And the offense, finishing 21st in runs scored and 15th in slugging, is just, it's unacceptable for a team with championship aspirations.
Even with a healthy Alvarez, they need a major power injection to balance that lineup. And this is why Pete Alonso is such a perfect, almost mandatory fit for them.
Let's elaborate on that fit. Why Alonso for Houston?
Well, it's the ballpark dimensions and the balance he provides. Alonso hitting balls into the short porch of the Crawford boxes in left field is just a dream scenario for them.
He provides immediate 40-homer production.
Right. And combined with Alvarez, it creates a formidable lefty-righty power combo in the heart of that order. Getting Alonso would instantly transform them from a bottom-half offense to a top-five offense, assuming health elsewhere.
But if they strike out on Alonso, their need for left-handed bats is still dire. Their lineup is so right-heavy.
They absolutely have to diversify their approach. If Alonso doesn't sign, they have to look at trade targets like Brendan Donovan or Brandon Lowe. Both are left-handed bats who could immediately slot in at second base.
Which would allow Jose Altuve to potentially shift to left field to mitigate some injury risk.
And lock Alvarez into the DH spot. They need that kind of switch-up to keep pitching staffs honest.
So the next layer of complexity for them is their trade capital and the financial juggling. We talk about shedding Dubon's salary, but what about major assets? Isaac Paredes keeps popping up in rumors.
And GM Dana Brown has been vehemently denying those rumors. He calls Paredes one of their best pitch watchers, crucial to their lineup.
But logic dictates that if you're going big for Alonso, you need to consolidate assets or clear even more salary.
Right. So if they keep Paredes, they might need to move veteran players. The more realistic trade chip, I think, is Christian Walker.
Who will be 35 next season.
Exactly. Trading him saves salary and allows Houston to shift Paredes to first base. That move clears the logistical path and the financial space needed to aggressively pursue a massive contract for Alonso. It's a move that signals a true regime change.
All right, let's shift to the free agent market and specifically the decisions that have already complicated the budgets for half a dozen teams. Mm-hmm. The accepted qualifying offers.
Yeah, the acceptance rate this year was surprisingly high. It injected a serious dose of uncertainty into the market. Four QOs accepted. That immediately took four high-value players off the board and committed over $80 million in guaranteed salary for next season.
Let's start with Brandon Woodruff. He accepted the Brewers' offer, $22 million for 1 year, even after he declined his mutual option.
And $22 million is just a massive figure for the Brewers organization. You called it uncharted territory for them.
It is historic for Milwaukee because their total annual payroll usually hovers around, what, $100 to $120 million?
Right. Committing $22 million to a single pitcher is an enormous percentage of their total budget. It's a fifth of their typical spending power for one player.
And he's coming off right shoulder surgery and a last strain, so it's a high-risk commitment.
It is, but his follow-up appointments were successful, and the organization believes he can anchor that rotation in the second half of 2026. So they justified the expense.
It's a sign they're serious about winning, but it instantly eliminates flexibility for other major signings.
That's exactly it. That $22 million is now unavailable for a much-needed hitter or a depth starter. They are betting on internal improvements and Woodruff's health.
But the acceptance that really rattled the divisional landscape was Shota Imanaga taking the Cubs' qualifying offer.
Oh, that decision was a strategic curveball the Cubs did not see coming. The prevailing assumption was that Imanaga would decline and seek a multi-year deal, probably in the range of, 3 years, $70 million.
So now the Cubs bring back a strong frontline starter, which is great competitively.
But it immediately eats up about $22 million of their budget.
And how does that affect their pursuit of other high-impact guys like Michael King or Dylan Cease?
It fundamentally limits their path forward. It forces a serious negotiation with the luxury tax threshold. If the Cubs have Imanaga and then immediately pivot to acquiring another major starter, they're almost guaranteed to breach the next luxury tax tier.
Which means higher penalties, lost draft capital.
Exactly. They have to be far more selective now. They might prioritize a cheaper, high-upside reliever or a mid-tier offensive upgrade rather than entering a bidding war for Cease, which would push them deep into penalty territory.
And as you pointed out, their division rival, the Cincinnati Reds, have to be thrilled that the Cubs are momentarily off balance.
It creates a crucial window of opportunity for them. If the Cubs are busy recalculating their budget, the Reds can potentially control the pace of the offseason.
We also saw Gleyber Torres and Trent Grisham accept their QOs. Grisham's was over $22 million for the Yankees.
And these are massive numbers for players who are not guaranteed superstars. The Yankees are pleased to retain a reliable piece in Grisham, but committing that $22 million now absolutely impacts their aggressive pursuit of Cody Bellinger.
Okay, let's talk about the true top tier of the market, Cody Bellinger. He remains the premier position player free agent, and this New York rivalry is shaping up to be the story of his free agency.
The Yankees are the clear favorites, full stop. Bellinger had a tremendous 2025 campaign. He proved he's back to elite form.
He hit .272, slugged 29 home runs, drove in 98.
He is the versatile left-handed offensive force the Yankees desperately need in the middle of their lineup. Rival execs view him as the most valuable remaining bat.
But the New York Mets and Steve Cohen are just lurking, ready to spoil the party.
If the Yankees hesitate, either over the years on the contract or because of luxury tax concerns after Grisham's acceptance, the Mets are ready to strike. Cohen has shown a willingness to swoop in and steal a star.
And Bellinger fits the Mets' shifting identity perfectly. They need athleticism, contact skills, high-quality defense.
Especially if they lose their other star slugger, Pete Alonso.
Which takes us right to Alonso. If the Mets can't keep the polar bear, where does he land?
The Boston Red Sox have been reported as the strongest contender for Alonso if he leaves Queens. That is a massive statement of intent from the Red Sox.
His power would play perfectly at Fenway.
Oh, absolutely. And as we discussed, the Astros view him as an essential prime fit for their power-starved lineup because of the Crawford boxes. This is a three-team race with incredible urgency from all sides.
Switching to pitching, the hottest name on the trade market and arguably the most impactful pitcher available is the two-time AL Cy Young winner, Tarik Skubal. The Tigers are gauging his value.
And the interest is bordering on frantic. Skubal is the trade ace. Insider reports have identified the Mets as a perfect landing spot, largely because Steve Cohen doesn't just want an ace. He wants the ace.
And he's willing to pay the massive prospect capital and then immediately offer an extension.
Exactly. The Red Sox are also heavily in the mix. Skubal's presence on the trade block is slowing down the entire pitching market.
Which brings us to the Minnesota Twins, who have two co-aces, Joe Ryan and Pablo Lopez, both potentially available.
But their trade market is completely dependent on Skubal. The Twins are navigating an ownership transition, complicating their long-term spending plans.
And they have these two incredibly valuable, cost-controlled pitchers.
And national reports strongly suggest that they will deal one, but not both, before their team control runs out in 2027. But no team is going to offer a premium package for Ryan or Lopez until the Skubal situation is resolved.
Why does Skubal's market specifically depress their value?
Because if a team can acquire a proven two-time Cy Young winner like Skubal, they're taking themselves out of the bidding for that next tier. Ryan is high value, but Lopez's value is already a little depressed due to health concerns. If the Mets or Red Sox land Skubal, the demand for Ryan immediately falls and the Twins have to accept a lesser return.
So the market's just in a holding pattern.
Waiting for Detroit.
Finally, let's analyze the closer market, specifically the tier just below the elite guys like Edwin Diaz. Devin Williams is creating a lot of chatter.
Especially about a possible reunion with the Yankees. Williams had a surprisingly tumultuous 2025. He had a 4.79 ERA, lost his closing duties in late July.
On the surface, those numbers are terrible.
They are, but if you dig into the underlying metrics, his elite level stuff is still there. His strand rate, which is the percentage of runners he leaves on base, plummeted from a career high of 83% to just 55%.
So that screams massive bad luck.
Exactly. Teams are viewing him as a high upside, buy low candidate. The Yankees are discussing bringing him back on a team-friendly deal, but other teams like the Dodgers, Reds, and Red Sox are connected. They see an opportunity here.
And the Orioles, despite trading for Ward, they still desperately need bullpen help.
Their bullpen has been gutted by injuries and trades. They're in a dire position. They are actively hunting for high-leverage options to establish a committee approach.
So guys like Kyle Finnegan.
Finnegan, who benefited from sharing duties in Detroit. Or they might look at established names like Pete Fairbanks or Ryan Helsley to solidify that committee heading into spring training.
Okay, as we approach Friday's non-tender deadline, the pressure to make these painful financial decisions is just mounting. This is the deadline that forces teams to weigh a player's projected arbitration salary against their actual performance.
And the value of their 40-man roster spot. This is where marginal decisions become existential. For clubs trying to manage the luxury tax, even a few million dollars saved can open up space for a much bigger signing.
But let's look at the Yankees. Despite their enormous wealth, they are strategically trying to clear space.
And the biggest name facing a tough decision is high-salary reliever Camilo Duval, who's projected to get $6.6 million in arbitration.
That's a significant number.
It is. His performance just wasn't consistently strong enough to justify that salary for a non-closer role, especially if the Yankees are planning on acquiring a high-impact reliever.
Or even re-signing Devin Williams.
Exactly. By non-tendering Duval, they save that $6.6 million, which can then be immediately reallocated. It's a ruthless calculation based purely on opportunity cost.
They're also looking at Mark Leiter Jr., projected at $3 million, and Oswaldo Cabrera at $1.2 million.
Cabrera's number is small, but his versatility might not be enough to save him. The Yankees have a crowded infield, and if they can use that 40-man spot for a higher upside pitching prospect, they might just cut ties.
The dilemma facing the Kansas City Royals at second base perfectly illustrates the burden of bad contracts for small market teams.
Oh, this is a classic resource allocation problem. They are struggling with what to do about Jonathan India and Michael Massey.
If they keep both, they're committing nearly $10 million to a second base platoon that was, frankly, below replacement level in 2025.
And for the Royals, who operate on a tight budget, $10 million tied up in below-average production is just crippling.
So what are the painful options?
Well, non-tendering India would free up most of that salary, but it leaves a massive hole at second. Non-tendering Massey saves less money, but he has more team control remaining. They have to decide whether to eat the $10 million or risk losing a potential trade asset.
And across the league, the Cincinnati Reds face a similar situation with former top prospect Gavin Lux.
Lux is projected to earn $5 million. That is a steep price for a player who ended 2025 as a below replacement level contributor. He hit .269 with only 5 home runs.
And the defensive shift is the killer here, right? He's primarily a left fielder now.
Which severely diminishes his value compared to when he was an infielder. With a crowded outfield, the Reds will almost certainly non-tender him. They'll bet that $5 million is better spent elsewhere.
The Guardians have an agonizing decision with the fan favorite, David Fry.
He's a realistic candidate to be non-tendered, even though his salary is low at $1.2 million. The problem is his production just isn't worth a 40-man spot right now. He posted a negative WAR, and after an elbow injury, his defense behind the plate became completely unplayable.
They just can't carry that.
Not when they need those spots for Rule 5 protection. And out on the West Coast, the Giants have to make a call on Joey Lucchese.
Who's projected at $2 million. He was actually pretty solid in 2025, a 3.76 ERA.
He was. But the fact that he's still listed as a non-tender risk just underscores how acutely teams are managing their relief corps budgets. If they see a cheaper, higher upside minor leaguer they need to protect, Lucchese becomes expendable.
Moving past the non-tender crunch, that 40-man roster construction is also being fiercely driven by the upcoming Rule 5 draft.
Teams are racing to clear space to protect their highest upside prospects. We saw a brilliant move from the Mets here.
The Frankie Montas move.
Yeah. They designated and released Montas, who's owed $17 million next year but is out due to UCL surgery. They immediately used that spot to select the contract of outfielder Nick Morabito.
So the Mets decided the 40-man spot was far more valuable than the sunk cost of Montas' salary.
And Morabito is a high-reward protection. He's got plus speed, a strong bat, he hit .362 in the fall league. He would have absolutely been claimed in the Rule 5 draft.
Now contrast that with the difficult decisions facing the Detroit Tigers. They have three critical Rule 5 eligible prospects.
And the toughest one centers on switch-hitting catcher Theron Lorenzo. He has rare 70-grade power, which is truly elite. If the Tigers expose him, he is guaranteed to be selected. They have to protect him.
Then there's infielder Hao-Yu Lee.
Lee's a disciplined hitter, had a strong AA run, but he's blocked in the system. Given that he was acquired in the Michael Lorenzen trade, they're unlikely to expose him. They invested assets in him.
And the final piece of their dilemma is Eduardo Valencia.
Valencia is a catcher first baseman whose power exploded in 2025 with 24 homers. But his catching defense is poor, and he's completely blocked at first base by Spencer Torkelson.
So do you dedicate a valuable 40-man spot to a backup first baseman with defensive limitations?
Or do you risk exposing him? It's a tough call because that 40-man spot is just so precious.
We're seeing organizations prioritize protection based on upside, even when health is a factor. The Pirates protected Jack Brannigan, even though he suffered a torn labrum.
Right. That decision signals their faith in his upside. They view him as a foundational piece, even if he misses the start of next season.
Conversely, the Braves are likely exposing right-hander Ian Mejia, despite his 2.62 ERA in AA.
And the reason is his stuff profile. It lacks high velocity and bat-missing ability, which gives him a lower ceiling and makes him less likely to stick on a Rule 5 roster for a full season.
Let's zoom out now and examine the broader organizational changes sweeping across the league, starting with the St. Louis Cardinals, who are undergoing a major culture shift under their new president of baseball operations, Chaim Bloom.
Bloom's arrival is leading to immediate structural changes. We saw the firing of Russ Steinhorn, their former minor league hitting coordinator. Steinhorn himself has spoken very highly of Bloom's intelligence and competitiveness.
He believes Bloom will use his experience to return the Cardinals to prominence.
Right. This is about changing the philosophy from within, supplementing that traditional Cardinals farm system with high-value outside talent.
And Steinhorn also provided some insight into their internal talent, specifically touting the potential of J.J. Weatherholt.
Weatherholt is viewed internally as a bona fide star in the making. His impending arrival, though, only highlights the Cardinals' immediate glaring need, the outfield.
Following the likely trade of Brendan Donovan, their outfield situation is described internally as rather bad.
That's putting it lightly. They are heading toward opening day with zero reliable outfielders.
This desperate need forces them to consider high-risk, buy-low candidates like Michael Conforto.
Conforto is the classic reclamation project. He had a truly terrible below replacement level season in 2025 with the Dodgers. They actually dropped him from their playoff roster.
But the Cardinals are looking at his history. He was a very good hitter as recently as 2024.
He was. He posted a 112 WRC plus dist. That's 12% better than league average after you adjust for ballpark.
So the argument is they're betting $17 million on 1 year, hoping his bat bounces back to 2024 levels, and then he becomes a trade ship at the deadline.
That's exactly it. He's a left-handed hitter, which they need. It's a one-year gamble, but it's a high-risk one. His defense in left field fell off a cliff last year. If the bat doesn't return to form, he is unplayable.
Beyond the clubs, Major League Baseball is structurally changing how we consume the product, finalizing these massive new media rights deals totals nearly $800 million annually over the next 3 years.
This is a significant shift in viewing habits and revenue streams. NBC, primarily through Peacock, has taken over Sunday Night Baseball and secured the rights to the Wild Card Series. They're paying around $200 million a year.
So that puts premium Sunday night content behind a streaming paywall.
It does. And then there's Netflix, jumping into live baseball action.
You got the Home Run Derby?
The Derby and two additional live games for about $50 million annually. This just shows MLB's commitment to tapping into these massive, non-traditional platforms.
Meanwhile, ESPN, which has been the cornerstone of national broadcasts, they lost all postseason games and the Derby.
They did. What they retained was MLB TV rights, the crucial out-of-market streaming service, and a 30-game midweek package. They're paying $550 million for this new bundle.
And crucially, they're also handling in-market streaming for six specific teams whose broadcast rights are now produced by MLB itself.
The Padres, Rockies, Diamondbacks, Guardians, Twins, and Mariners.
Let's discuss the financial consequence, though. Because while $800 million sounds enormous, MLB reportedly took a significant haircut compared to the previous deals.
They did. MLB's total national rights revenue is projected to be about $300 million annually less than what ESPN was paying for its previous full package.
And that reduction in national revenue has significant long-term implications, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That $300 million reduction means less national revenue is flowing into the central distribution pool. Since revenue sharing is based on total league revenue, this puts pressure on teams, especially those in smaller markets,
who rely on those national checks to offset local revenue deficiencies.
Right. While the effect isn't immediate, it increases the urgency for smaller market teams to maximize their local TV contracts. It further justifies why we see teams like the Royals making brutal cost-saving decisions on players like Jonathan India. The financial margins are just becoming thinner for everyone outside the top few markets.
That is a deep insight. Before we wrap up, let's quickly cover some of the fun and interesting news items surrounding the World Series champion Dodgers.
Mookie Betts, who is 33 now, wrapped up his 12th season and his second straight World Series win, even with a down year at the plate where he hit just .258.
He's just a veteran leader. And the high praise for Shohei Ohtani continues. He got his second World Series title and fourth MVP award.
LeBron James even compared Ohtani's dominance in baseball to Stephen Curry's revolutionary influence in the NBA.
Which is about as high as praise gets.
It is. And if you're looking for a piece of that history, the auction market is already hot. Artifacts from Game 7, Will Smith's home run ball is bid at $130,000, and Miguel Rojas' homer ball is at $70,000.
Incredible. Looking ahead, we have the film Homecoming, the Tokyo series, chronicling that Dodgers-Cubs season opener in Japan.
That's going to be great. It really highlights the globalization of the game. And closer to home, MLB is bringing back the Field of Dreams game in Dyersville, Iowa on August 13th, 2026.
Minnesota Twins and the Philadelphia Phillies, a lovely nod to tradition.
It is.
And finally, we had that fascinating hypothetical where a fan, acting as the Rockies' GM, tried to rebuild the franchise.
It was an interesting case study. The hypothetical GM signed Rhys Hoskins to a three-year, $30.6 million deal.
Hoping Coors Field would boost his power.
Right, and then dramatically claimed Royce Lewis off waivers from the Twins. In that simulation, the Rockies finished the offseason adding 7.7 war, which was second only to the Yankees' 8.2 war game.
It just shows that aggressive, high-upside moves, even if they carry risk, can drastically change a team's outlook. A bold thought experiment for a franchise that desperately needs momentum. What an intense week of transactions, and it's all driven less by rumor and more by these ironclad deadlines. The pace of movement around this November 20th timeline, specifically the non-tender crunch and the Rule 5 protection efforts, it just proves that financial pressures dictate action.
The key takeaway for me is the stark separation we're seeing between the contenders and those still rebuilding. The Orioles were willing to move 4 years of cost-controlled pitching for 1 year of immediate impact.
While the Angels were desperate to absorb that high-risk control.
Exactly. And meanwhile, you have the Astros and the Yankees maneuvering around fractions of millions of dollars so they can afford the next massive star. The urgency is just palpable.
And those accepted qualifying offers, especially Shota Imanaga's surprise acceptance by the Cubs, that has undeniably tightened the purse strings for the top spenders. It's making their next decision significantly harder.
Which raises an important question for you, the listener, to mull over. Given the surprising impact of those accepted QOs on team budgets and flexibility, forcing clubs like the Cubs and Yankees to recalculate, what percentage of the remaining major free agents, your Bellingers, your Alonzos, your Valdeses, do you think will actually sign before the end of the calendar year?
That's a great question. Will the urgency of spring training force them to sign anyway, or will the tightened purse strings drag this market well into January?
It's going to be fascinating to watch.
That's a great thought to close on. The dominoes have started falling, but it sounds like the biggest ones might be stuck until the new year. We'll be tracking all the moves and deadlines right here on the Baseball Podcast. We appreciate you joining us for this analysis.
Until next time.